Thank you. Be seated.
Great, great. Your oral argument from Petitioner James Perry versus Nash.
Good morning, Your Honors. You may please this honorable court. I'm speaking on behalf of three petitioners who urged successfully at the trial court below that Section 261.101A of the Texas Family Code is not an appropriate basis for negligence per se or gross negligence claim. Briefly, the facts supporting the decision below. The plaintiff ended below that their minor children were physically and sexually abused by the proprietor of the daycare center between March 25 and August 28, 1991. The only specific date of abuse that is alleged in the court pleading filed by plaintiffs below was an abuse that occurred in approximately August 1991, as appears on page 12 of the court's record. The petitioners are three persons who were contended to have known of the acts of abuse and yet did not report them at unspecified times. They were sued below in theories of negligence and negligence per se. The trial court, in response to the petitioner's motion for summary judgment below, granted no duty summary judgments on the negligence and negligence per se claims. The Court of Appeals below affirmed the trial court's summary judgment as to the common law claims, reversed the trial court as to the negligence per se claims. The narrow question before this court is whether Section 261.101A creates or should be adopted by this court as defining a standard of care. Petitioners recognize that while the 261 series of the Family Code advances an important and paramount public interest, that is the protection of children, the framework that's created by the 261 series of the Family Code simply is not workable to be adopted by this court as defining a tort standard of care and a tort duty. I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
The failure to report under these circumstances a crime in Texas.
Yes, it's penalized under that section.
Got to be a lot more specific than the civil tort duty statute.
That is generally true, Your Honor. I believe there is one case that has tested whether or not this case or this statute is void for vagueness as a criminal statute. In a court of appeals case out of Houston, it was held that certain provisions were not unconstitutionally void for not imparting fair notice, that a person would not know what type of actions were criminal.
So if it's sufficient for criminal prosecution, why would it be insufficient for civil liability for violating that statute?
For three principal reasons, Your Honor. First, although it has been tested by one court of appeals as a criminal statute, it has not yet been adopted by this court, and there are three principal reasons in our core contentions why it should not be adopted by this court. Our first, that number one, the framework of Section 261 and its subcomponents, they don't easily transfer into being a workable tort duty, and I'll explain why that series or that framework under 261 is intended to advance a legislative goal and doesn't transfer easily to a tort duty. Secondly, the foreseeability element of a cause of action should the court adopt 261 and its subcomponents as creating a tort duty is so problematic as to be unworkable, as the members of the court who were trial judges remember how to charge the jury and how this court's pattern jury charge committee devises and constructs jury charges. We contend that it's unworkable. And finally, we would contend that the adoption of 261.101A as a tort duty would cause a proliferation of destructive litigation. Now, I'd address first, with the permission of the court, what this statute is intended to accomplish. We would urge that in the totality of 261 and its components, a person who has cause to believe that a child's physical or mental welfare has been or may be affected by abuse or neglect has to immediately make a report. Under this section, a professional such as a teacher, a nurse, a doctor, or a daycare professional has 48 hours within which to make a report. Under the statute as it's presently written, those who are presumably better qualified to make those determinations about whether a child's welfare is being affected have a longer period of time within which to report the suspected acts of abuse. Under 261, there's a provision that in effect trumps the attorney-client privilege, clergy privilege, medical practitioner privileges, and mental health professionals' privileges. Furthermore, 261 creates an immunity from civil or criminal liability for those who make a good faith report to a law enforcement authority. It also allows immunized reporting persons to recover attorney's fees if they are later sued and the contention is made that it was not a good faith report. 261 also makes confidential the report, the identity of the reporter, and all of the investigations that are conducted as a result of the report made to the agency. In totality, Your Honor, in addressing Justice Enix's specific concern, the statutory scheme that's constructed under 261 is well suited to the promotion of the investigation of suspected acts of child abuse. However, it would take a broad leap for this court to conclude that one section of this statutory scheme was either intended by, or it would be prudent for this court to adopt that section as creating a tort duty.
Are you aware of any other statutes that make certain omissions of conduct, failure to do something, a criminal offense, that this court or any other court has declared is not a that it does not create a duty per se?
Your Honor, I would characterize probably three categories of decisions that this court has held probably either do or do not create a negligence per se duty, which I think are instructive. And those would be what I'd characterize as the motor vehicle statute cases, the alcohol cases, and the cases that have to do with matters relating to building codes and construction buildings. At the threshold, and to directly answer Your Honor's question, the motor vehicle cases present a particular set of circumstances in which the court has at some time said that the statute under the Highway Code may or may not be alleged as a negligence per se cause of action if the claimant can prove the breach of a duty. In the Parrott versus Garcia case from this court in 1969, which is the drag racing case, we believe that's particularly illuminating because that's an example of a case where an omission or an act under a statute, a failure to comply with a statute, can be isolated and identified as being, in effect, an injury-producing event. Contrasted to this case, this statute, in its criminal context, is directed at the reporting of conduct that has already occurred. We believe that that makes the proximate cause element very problematic. Now, with regard to the alcohol cases, and the cases beginning with El Chico in 1987 and up through this court's decision, Smith versus Merritt in 1997, it's clear that when you look at an industry such as the vending of alcohol and an activity that is so heavily regulated by the legislature, professionals who have been trained and happen to be trained and demonstrate a level of competence before even receiving permission from the state to engage in a particular activity, they are held to a different standard, and it's easy to see in those cases why the violation of a statute that prohibits, for example, the sale of alcohol to an obviously intoxicated person, why that can cause the injury-producing event. Contrasted again with Section 261.101A, which focuses on reporting of suspected conduct that has already occurred. And finally, with regard to the building code or the, what I call the construction cases, the most illuminating in our contention is the MOPAC versus Austin American Statesman case from 1977 that had to do with the construction of a railroad tram to a proper clearance. Now, in that case, the reason that statute was a good fit is that it was easy to see how someone who is in the business and who is charged with compliance with building a railroad track to a proper clearance could be charged with not only complying with the building code provision, but also have that be defined as a standard of care by the court, because the construction of the tram at a proper clearance would have prevented the type of damage for which the plaintiff sought recovery. Contrasted with this case, there is not the type of clear and direct connection between the failure to report and the injury that is claimed. Petitioners submit that that
clear and direct connection between the failure to report and the injury that is claimed. Petitioners submit the basis for the claim and the argument but for the person's failure to report. The second, the third half of the claims would not occur. Make the argument but for the basis.
Yes, Your Honor, in that there are certain types of cases where that contention could be made, where the failure to report could have prevented a subsequent act of abuse, and that was something that was cited by former Justice Cornyn in his concurrence in the Golden Spread case. The difference, Justice Baker, between what you have propounded and the need to adopt this statute as defining as a standard of care is as follows. There is no certainty that the reporting, picking up the phone and calling the authorities, as former Justice Cornyn noted in Golden Spread, would actually prevent subsequent acts of abuse, because we would have to assume that the report would be received timely and that other authorities over whom the reporter would have no control would investigate it timely, investigate it thoroughly, and reach the proper conclusion. And that's one of the reasons, Justice Baker, that this statute is particularly fraught with peril in terms of saying that it defines a tort standard of care. Because unlike the other cases in which this court has adopted standards, rather statutes as defining a standard of care, there is no, this statute is not directed at a perpetrator.
The result of proximate cause. Per se just says you don't have to decide that this was above or below the standard of ordinary prudence. It's just violated. You then move to the proximate cause issue. So, even if this were a per se violation, there would still have to be evidence that failure was a proximate cause of the injury. And I don't see how that's any more problematic than any other per se violation under criminal statute.
Your Honor, the reason is, for example, if the court will bear with me, imagine a case in which a perpetrator and a person who is a reporter or a reported reporter who failed to make the report were sued together. The broad form submission would say, would the negligence, if any, of the persons named below approximately caused the incident or the injuries complained of? Then there'd be a line for the perpetrator and a line for the reporter. Somewhere in there would have to be a charge to the jury that says negligence means the failure, the knowing failure to report suspected incidences of abuse or neglect of a child. Failure to report is negligence in and of itself. There is, in effect, blended within that charge what in other circumstances wouldn't be a comment on the weight of the evidence, but in this case may very well be. That's the first problem. The second problem is that the statute, although the court is correct, and your observation is perfectly valid, that the proximate cause element still has to be there. In cases such as this, it is not the type of statute that is directed as a perpetrator, and that's why it's different. In the other cases where this court has said the statute defines the standard of care, it is easy to draw the conclusion that if the reporter or if the person who was charged with complying with the statute had complied, the injury-producing conduct would not have occurred. Here, it's difficult to charge the jury that that conduct, that failure to report, is negligence, and then have us go to the second step and have them make findings with regard to proximate cause.
Mr. Jerry, are you, in this instance, are you arguing under the current Texas test, the restatement test, or are you proposing that the court adopt a different test to determine when a statute can be used as the basis for negligence per se action?
Your Honor, presently, we would suggest that even applying the restatement test, which is the test before the court under the back from the Ipsum case in 1967, I believe, or 72, that is the test, and when applying that test, we still reach the conclusion that this statute does not fit the test.
Are you aware of the cases in 1967, I believe, 72, that is the test, and when applying that test, on these types of grounds, infection.
Your Honor, there are reported appellate decisions. For instance, the Court of Appeals cases that have been the precursor to the Butcher versus Scott case with regard to those cases probably more precisely say that the court in that, the appellate court, declined to adopt the statute as the defining standard of care. I haven't found one case that outlines all of the particular grounds that I've articulated here, but I think if you draw from the body of the cases that have dealt with this particular issue of the Court of Appeals and contrast that with other cases where the court has adopted a statute as defining standard of care, we reach that conclusion.
The body of the cases that have dealt with this particular issue before the court is ready to hear argument, contrast that with other cases where the court has adopted a statute as defining standard of care, we reach that conclusion.
Good morning. The real question this court will be answering in this case is whether or not the civil law is going to be made available to protect the children of this state. Try as I might, I cannot see this as a difficult case that my opponent seems to try to make it. And the point that
the cause of action belongs to the child. Is that correct? It's assuming that we were to recognize the cause of action to the child.
Absolutely.
And the damages would go presumably to the child. And that would mean that because it's a minor, usually in these situations, that limitations would be out there for 18 years or so. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That is entirely possible. And in these types of cases, cases dealing with child abuse, unfortunately the damage far exceeds even 18-year statute of limitations, which might apply in a matter of a child.
How does allowing a child, once they reach majority, to sue for something that may have happened 15 years ago, further the interest of the statute, which is immediately requiring people to report child abuse to authorities to investigate promptly? How does allowing a damage action 15 years further that?
Well, it depends. I believe that if a tortfeasor is brought to justice even 15 years after the tort was committed, I believe that is a valid policy that this state should pursue.
Why doesn't the criminal statute adequately protect
that? I don't know how to answer that question. I can simply say that it doesn't, because I don't see how you can ever say we have enough protection for our children from child abuse. When the instances of child abuse are notorious, we hear about them all the time, and it's something that we can't escape in our society. And
I don't allow a child, once they reach majority, to sue a parent or a grandparent or a stepparent.
I'm sorry.
Taking this to the logical conclusion, a child who reached majority can sue a parent, a step-parent, a grandparent many, many years after the alleged abuse occurred for damages.
That is possible. That is possible. Just like as occurs sometimes today, that a child will sue someone who abused them after they reached the majority. That I'm certain that instance could happen. However, that does not mean that we should not basically throw out the baby with the bathwater and say that this statute does not establish a duty, the violation of which is negligence per se. As far as I'm aware, the state does follow the restatement of torts, as outlined by this court in the Ensign case, and talking about when a criminal statute will not be used as negligence per se. And that case set out five factors, the restatement of torts, I think it's section 288A, the five factors are, among others, when a statute is not an appropriate statute to adopt for negligence per se. And this case clearly doesn't fit in any of those factors. When this court in the past has said, here is a criminal statute, it's clearly designed to protect a particular class of persons who have been a violation of the statute and damages proximately resulting to a member of the class the statute was designed to protect, that is negligence. That's the law. Now, this court has on occasion said we must carve an exception to that law because this particular statute will not work in a just way. And in fact, it's been codified in the second restatement, section 288A. There are times when you can have someone, because of lack of capacity, an 8-year-old who jaywalks. Well, they can't be held to an adult standard. They have to be held to an 8-year-old standard. Impossibility to comply with the criminal statute, or when compliance with the criminal statute will put yourself in greater danger.
Because of lack of capacity.
In these certain instances, this court has in the past held that that particular statute is not a statute which should be used for establishing a much similar state standard. But that is not this case. This statute is easy to apply.
In these cases, just for my record, the case that you referenced that sets forth those five statutes, is that the implicit facts?
Yes, it is. Ensign versus Rushford Metal, the site is 487 Southwest 2nd, 694.
Okay, thanks. What's the standard that you
That is correct.
To the authorities laid out in the statute.
That is correct.
If you see abuse at a school and report it, report a teacher's abuse or another student's abuse to the principal,
then you have not carried out your civil responsibility.
That's certainly possible. However, our case, it's possible that you have not carried out your civil duty if you see abuse and do not report it.
You have cause to believe. I mean, you know,
exactly. If you have cause to believe. However, that cause
to
believe.
So you may well lose
your
job.
That's certainly possible. However, in this case, seeing actual abuse occur, we argue, is sufficient to establish cause to believe. In this case, we allege that the defendant witnessed the owner of a daycare center abusing children in his charge. And we state that that gave cause to believe that other children at the center may be abused by that actor.
The facts of this case are particularly egregious.
Yes, they are.
Abusing children. But if we were to adopt the statute,
and we state that that gave cause to believe
to facts,
that
not quite so
other children at the center may be abused.
Which is still bad. But let's assume that a parent goes to a grocery store with a child,
yes,
and he has to run in very quickly and leaves the child in a car seat, in your car, and comes back out 10 minutes later. Arguably, every person who passed that by, let's say 50 people who passed by, to view that child locked in that car in a car seat with the parent has witnessed the incident. Child abuse and child neglect that harms that child, perhaps both physically and mentally.
Every person
would the child be able to sue each of those 50 people who passed by who did not report
that neglect?
Locked in
that car.
Well, let me say it this way. It's my belief that if we adopt this statute, that child would be able to sue each of those 50 people. Why would that not lead to such an extreme situation that makes this particular statute not one that is suitable?
Well,
let me
say this
as a standard of care.
It's my belief.
In that situation, we will have to have one other event transpire in order for the cause of action to be successful. We must satisfy proximate cause element. Now, if you take your example further and the child was later seriously injured or died because he was stuck in a locked car in the middle of August, and you had people who knew, that person left that child locked in the car when they went into the store. In other words, I had cause to believe that this child was in danger from neglect or abuse. Then yes, the state of the child might have a cause of action against someone who knew that might happen and yet did not satisfy their legal duty to do something about it.
But even if he does not, suppose he keeps on being abused, his argument is going to be, if you'd reported it, it would have come to light, the authorities would have stopped it, and I wouldn't have been a huge target. Therefore, you're responsible for
that. Might happen.
Isn't that the argument?
Yes. If he would have reported it, then it would have come to light. Now, if the person had reported it, now they've satisfied their legal obligation. They are not going to be exposed to criminal liability or civil liability.
But if they don't report it, as far as the plaintiff is concerned, they're liable for everything else that happens. Because the reporting of it would have stopped the abuse.
That is correct. Or the duty is to report. So if they reported it, first of all, they're off the hook.
But if they don't, they're off the hook.
But if they don't report it,
the petitioner says that the other duties have been created when you've had some sort of training or expertise.
You know,
selling liquor and presumably the training by
that is correct. Or the duty is to report.
So if they report it, come under all those duties,
but if they don't, they're off the hook forever.
You've got to generally know those traffic laws or you can't be driving. But here, this is just a duty on the world, on you and on me. We keep our eyes open and
drive a car,
distinguish between child abuse and what's discretionary child rights. That's a pretty awesome duty, isn't it? I mean, I don't believe I can go to the grocery store.
You've got to generally know the traffic laws.
Having to make some judgment world on you and on me.
Well, there is a difference called to be made, but this court is not creating a duty. The duty is there. The criminal statute exists. We have that duty. We all, as adults, have that duty. Now,
let's talk about what's the penalty? What for a Class B misdemeanor? What's the range of punishment?
Right.
Having to make a judgment call.
not being an expert on criminal law, I believe it's up to a maximum of 6 months in jail on a class B misdemeanor, although I'm not certain.
Right, if we were to adopt this ordinance,
we have that duty.
We have to shut down the statute, is that correct?
Sure.
And you would be subject to punitive damages in addition to actual damages under a civil violation of the statute.
Not being an expert on criminal law, I believe,
yes, so we would be imposing, in some cases, civil penalties as far as the criminal law.
Yes. But it's not a, but you're not imposing civil penalties. What you're doing when you recognize negligence per se cause of action.
What are punitive damages?
What punitive damages are penalties. But the actual damages, punitive damages, we must remember, are tied to your actual damages. What we're allowing to happen is for our child to recover their actual damages that they incurred because of the violation of the statute. We can't forget our duty as adults to protect the children. These children cannot protect themselves. That's why this chapter of the Family Code exists. That's why it is a criminal duty. That in itself is almost extraordinary that there is a criminal duty to report when you have cause to believe that a child is in danger.
Do you know whether this statute is broader or narrower than other state statutes?
I don't believe that it. I don't believe that the statute is particularly broad.
Do you know whether it is broader or narrower than other state statutes? Do you know?
I do not know. I'm sorry. I didn't understand the question.
You allege abuse starting in March, but female women would not be responsible for any abuse until after they saw the event you allege they saw in August.
I don't believe that the statute is particularly... Well, that's not exactly correct. We've alleged actually that one of these defendants knew Fran Keller well, was a close personal friend of Fran Keller, and that she would have known of these events of abuse long before. Obviously, when they actually witnessed it, abuse, that's a watershed event for... It's almost conclusive that they would have cause to believe that these children's welfare would be in danger. However, the allegations are broader than that. It simply has one event, at least with respect to one of the defendants that is alleged that she knew the defendant quite well, and that or one of the defendants, and Fran Keller, had confided in her about Fran Keller's abusive nature.
Does the criminal statute have
that these children's welfare would be in danger? However, I'm not aware if it doesn't.
The allegations are broader than that. I would especially have a at least with respect to one.
If you sue the daycare owner for controlling the premises and allowing employees negligence, could he sue another employee? And he didn't know it was happening. Could he sue another employee who did know it was happening?
I'm not aware of it.
And didn't report it.
So I'm assuming now the owner of the daycare is an innocent actor.
Well, he owned the premise.
Okay.
And the allegation is you never should let this guy be.
He negligently hired someone who was abusing the children. Someone else knew about it, took no action to report it.
Could he sue another employee? He did know that.
I would think so.
If this is the child's cause of action, as you said earlier, what cause of action do parents have? What rights do they have to recover money for their own?
They do have, I probably misspoke when I said it was solely the child's cause of action. Certainly it is the child's cause of action. However, the parents would retain the cause of action for the medical expenses that they've incurred because of the injuries to the children. So they were going to have their individual responsibility for that which they can sue for. I also believe that the parents should be able to recover loss of consortium or the damage caused to
the statute shows that they're
protected class. There's nothing in the statute which specifically states that parents are protected class. The statute seems to be directed primarily at protected children, which seems correct since the children are the ones who cannot protect themselves adequately. However, because the statute, simply because the statute doesn't speak to protecting the parents' interest, I believe they would have a derivative cause of action, certainly, if their children are injured, to sue for their own injuries
that they would incur because the children were taken ill. And I believe it causes grievous damage to the parents when they find out that the children have been abused by someone else.
To protect the parents.
Another parent.
I believe.
I'm sorry?
One of the parents.
I believe they would have a derivative cause.
Certainly.
Children are injured to sue for their own injury.
In their brief,
they would.
Petitioners have attempted to distinguish this case from cases in the past, and this court should recognize causes of action based on doing something or failing to do something, and I'm thinking now of the El Chico versus Poole case. And they attempt to say, well, the El Chico versus Poole case, the case is quite clear. That's certainly a type of case, providing alcohol to an obviously intoxicated person, that we can apply and we can come up with a charge with and we can use as a proper negligence per se cause of action. But this statute is too vague, or this statute is too difficult to apply. I don't see what the difference is. When a person is serving alcohol to an obviously intoxicated person, that person, the server has to use their judgment to determine whether the person is obviously intoxicated. When El Chico was basically codified or modified by Chapter 2 of the Alcoholic Beverage Code, the state said that a person can incur liability for serving alcohol to a person who is obviously intoxicated to the extent they pose a danger to themselves or others. That calls for the same judgment call as this statute calls for when a person with cause to believe a child is in danger is required to report. Similarly, approximate cause in El Chico versus Poole, the liability in that case is predicated on the driver being drunk at the time they're served alcohol. How do you prove that the automobile accident is subsequently caused, is not caused by the drunkenness that existed at the time the defendant did the tortious conduct, which is serve more alcohol to an obviously intoxicated person? And as the court recognized earlier, that is the jury question. That's the proximate cause question. Just because this court recognizes that a statute establishes a duty, the violation of which is negligence per se, doesn't summarily end the discussion, as I would believe my opponents are arguing, or at least inferring that it does. There is still an approximate cause element. We still have the protection of going, the defendant would still have the protection of going to before a jury and saying, wait a minute. If you're talking about recording one instance, if you're talking about one instance of child abuse, I didn't record it, and I didn't, then there's no damages approximately coming to me because there's no subsequent abuse by that particular actor. They can make that argument, and we're not asking this court to take that argument away. Of course they can make that argument. However, when a child who is next friend can go before a jury and say, I was abused, and I continue to be abused, that person knew about it. That person had the opportunity to stop it. All they had to do, to paraphrase Justice Cornyn, is pick up the phone. That's all they had to do. That's what shut this daycare down in this case. Someone picked up the phone and called and reported Fred and Dan Keller. The state jumped in and they shut it down. And there are no kids being abused by Fred and Dan Keller anymore. And they won't be for another 48 years.
Well, the criminal system took care of
that. Yes, they did.
But not the civil case.
I'm sorry?
There was no need for civil liability to get rid of Keller. The criminal system took care of that.
That's correct. That's correct. They are both in TDC now. They'll be for a very long time. Well, in the respondent superior, though, the employer is only liable for acts which occur in the course and scope of employment. And when we go through the test as determining whether or not an actor's actions are in the course and scope of employment, then we would have to determine if it's the question as to whether or not someone
didn't report, you would have to look at whether that was in the scope of the employment of the particular actor to determine whether
it was filed.
Requires clear order, though. The employer is only liable for actions for the employment. And when we go through the test as determining whether or not an actor's actions are in the course of the employment.
Can you ever spun in superior order for the violation of the statute?
That's an open question. You can. You can. If you have a situation where it's within the scope of that employee, the general nature of their job, they're charged to do something, as in this case they are charged to make reports when they are aware that a child is in danger, then yes, if that is their job, you can have response. Even if it's
bad. Any other questions? Thank you, Jim.
That's an open question. You can. If you have a situation where it's within...
Mr. Jerry, why doesn't this statute pass a two-part restatement test? It's a rather simple test.
That being that the person falls within the category of persons, it meets that part of the test.
All right,
there's
and
no
what,
question.
And what about whether or not the statute defines the standard of conduct of a reasonable person, which is the second element of the test?
Under that standard, my response to that would be that to determine what a reasonable person would do under the same or similar circumstances requires further inquiry, and there may actually be fact issues within the framework of this statute with regard to whether or not a person had cause to believe that someone is being adversely affected.
Why is standard cause to believe any different than trying to decide what a reasonable person would do?
They are very close to being the same, Your Honor. I would concede that.
Then why doesn't the statute pass both parts of
the
test?
Your Honor, at some level, it probably does pass both parts of the test.
Well, then does this court need to change the test if we are going to reject the adoption of the evidence and say action in this instance?
Your Honor, that's a good question. I thought about that after I answered the question in the first part of my presentation. I was thinking of the balancing that the court has historically engaged in terms of taking or determining if the statute satisfies the restatement test and then balancing the other competing interests to determine if the statute should be adopted. Now, with regard to that, the specific factors I had in mind were the magnitude of the burden against placed upon the defendant and the consequences of placing a burden upon the defendant. And those, I must confess, were the factors that I was thinking of in terms of engaging in a balancing test. The questions from the panel to Mr. Roach display how this is so problematic. The question with regard to third-party practice, for example, and to finally answer the question, Your Honor, if the court believes that needs to be clarified, it is my understanding and my view that that is part of the jurisprudence and part of the balancing that has to be undergone under the present law. To the extent that needs to be clarified, then that may be something that can be done in this case.
In what cases should we look to for this balancing?
Your Honor, I'd cite the court specifically to the Roots versus Gottschalk case. It is also discussed in Butcher versus Scott and Parrott versus Garcia. It's not expressed in the terms that I've articulated, but I believe that those factors can be drawn from the holdings in this case.
Have you considered the factors that were set up
to the extent that needs to be clarified, then that may be something that can be done in the case.
And basically, Judge Abbott, that goes off of, expands upon the Impson factors, if I'm remembering those as well. I can't articulate them as we stand here, but the short answer is no. I can't articulate and compare and contrast those factors that Professor Ratliff alluded to, but I would suggest that the factors that should be considered by the court in doing this balancing with respect to the burden that would be placed upon the defendant would first, as Your Honor pointed out, the problematic situation with third-party practice. If someone were at a baseball game at Arlington Stadium, the ballpark in Arlington, and saw a parent slap a child, would there then be people in the immediate vicinity, or would there be thousands of people who could be potential third-party defendants later on? The second problem is the statute of limitation problems, as Justice Owen alluded to, with regard to when that cause of action accrues or when it would be time-barred, and how long children would have to later pursue this type of cause of action. The third type of problem is the indivisible nature of the injury, as alluded to by Justices Heck and Chief Justice Phillips. For example, if this abuse occurred between March and August of 1991, there would be no way, or as Justice Heck pointed out in his question, if this case were tried, then it is conceivable that a reporter who failed to report could be liable for an indivisible injury, because it would be difficult to segregate out what effects happened from the March to August time frame for the abuse and the August forward time frame for abuse, and that would be incredibly problematic. The respondeat superior problem is an additional problem with the statute. There are an unusual potential class of claims. For example, in a three-children family, could the youngest child sue the older siblings 15 years down the line or within 2 years after reaching majority because you didn't call the police when mom spanked me too hard? And I feel badly about that, and that has affected my physical and mental well-being. The potential problems with saying that this statute creates a civil cause of action balance and mitigates strongly against the adoption of this statute as defining a standard of care. As the court has pointed out in the other questions, the criminal procedures, the criminal penalties under the statute, as Justice Gonzalez pointed out, provide ample opportunity to protect children. This statute creates a framework. The consequences of saying that lifting out a portion of that statute out of that framework and saying that it creates a civil cause of action are incredible in terms of the burden that would be placed upon defendants and the unusual situations that are not, and frankly, Your Honors, should not be the law, should not be the tort law of this case because of the problems with limitations, because of the problems with the enormous class of potential third-party defendants, because of the fact that this, in essence, can help perpetrators. If a perpetrator is sued with a reporter and has prior decisions this court has held, perpetration and sexual abuse is not a matter that's covered under traditional insurance policy. I can conceive of situations where it would be to the perpetrator's benefit, or if one non-reporter is sued, and every neighbor down the street is subsequently sued as an additional third-party defendant, or in Chief Justice Phillips' hypothetical, the people at Toys R Us, when I was shopping at Toys R Us during the holiday season, when you see something, the class of potential defendants, should the court adopt this as defining a standard of care and a tort duty, is enormous. And it could do nothing but, in the long run, benefit the
public. I have a question. It seems to me those greater correlations affect even the criminal prosecution. You have all the people in the ballpark who are subjected to 6 months in jail because of mother slapping child in the early court.
Yes, sir.
What keeps that from happening is you have a prosecutor who just chooses not to prosecute. And that, what is different between a prosecutor just choosing not to prosecute and a jury just saying there's no proximate cause? I mean, what's the difference between 12 people exercising their authority to find no proximate cause from all the people in the baseball stadium when the mother slapped her child, as opposed to a prosecutor, an individual, an elected official sitting in a county who just arbitrarily decides, maybe not arbitrarily, maybe having looked at the facts, decides I'm not going to prosecute? What's the difference? Except that an abused child has no, there's no duty of this report that will compensate the abused child for their damages.
My response to that, Justice Enoch, would be that in the case of a criminal prosecution, an administrative officer stands between the action and the filing of an action, who is charged with the duty of determining if there is probable cause to go forward and marshaling evidence to do that. In the civil context, there is no such filter. Anyone can go down and file a lawsuit.
There's some sanction for filing frivolous lawsuits.
Yes, Your Honor, there is. And that, on the other end, is a control over filing frivolous lawsuits. But under this statute, there's immunity to someone who makes a good faith report. And how that fits into the requirements under Rule 13 and the relevant provision of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code about frivolous lawsuits is another matter that is simply simply difficult to say to adopt this statute without finding standard of care comments.
Any other questions? Thank you. The argument and the second call.
Yes, Your Honor.